38 degrees Kenosha, 37 now in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. 50 years ago this week, two astronauts from the crew of Apollo 17 were walking on the surface of the moon. To date, it is the last time that human beings have been to the moon. To commemorate that anniversary, we have two very special interviews for you today. One, a newly recorded interview that talks about an amazing book released specifically for this anniversary, called Apollo Remastered. Part two from the archives is a conversation with an astronaut from the Apollo 15 mission, Al Warden, talking about his memoir, Falling to Earth. Here's part one. And I am exceptionally excited about the interview that you are about to hear, because it is about a stunningly beautiful and fascinating book called Apollo Remastered, The Ultimate Photographic Record. This magnificent book, which really needs to be seen to be fully believed and appreciated, captures an extraordinary array of photographs and stills from film that chronicle most specifically the Apollo missions that took human beings to the moon, and also some interesting photographic artifacts, if you will, from some of the missions that predated Apollo. And these are images seen in a clarity never before experienced. And the man responsible for this amazing book is Andy Saunders, who has done all kinds of groundbreaking work in the art of remastering photographic images. And the result of his loving work is this amazing book published by Black Dog and Leventhal. Again, Apollo Remastered, The Ultimate Photographic Record. Andy Saunders, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Greg. Good morning.
One of the things that's important for our listeners to understand is the sort of unprecedented nature of what they get to see in this book. In terms of, in certain cases, images that have never really been seen before by the public, and in many other cases, images that we have seen, but not in the way that we see them in this book. Explain that important distinction.
Yeah, well, I mean, the start of the project, one of the reasons was my frustration with the quality of what we've always seen. And it didn't really make any sense, because they used the best cameras, the best film, the best photo lab. You know, we should have always been seeing them in a better state. So when I looked into this, the key reason is the original film. So this is the film that was actually in the cameras on the moon. Once they got back from the moon landings, that original film, it's so delicate and so important, you don't want to handle it more than once. So they didn't. So they processed it, they made a master duplicate copy, and then the originals went into this frozen vault in Building 8 in Johnson Space Center, and they remain there pretty much untouched for half a century. And everything we've seen since has been based on the duplicates or copies of duplicates or copies of copies. And at every copy, there's a degradation in quality. So that's one of the reasons that we've never been able to see them in their best state. But that film, that original film, has finally made it out of the frozen vault and has been digitally scanned to an incredibly high resolution. A resolution whereby everything that's in that film is captured in these digital scans. So in applying the latest digital processing to that, which you have to do because these scans, if you think of it, they're effectively a digital photograph of a piece of film that's in a camera. So and that's the other thing that hasn't happened before is we've taken lower quality scans and people just, turn the brightness up and put them online or print them. But you can't do that with analog film, with a digital scan of analog film. You have to digitally process it. So that's what I've done. With the original flight film, I've also utilised an unusual stacking technique on the 16mm film and just been able to bring out detail that we've never been able to see before.
Hmm. You tell us in the foreword to the book that you looked carefully inspected 35,000 images in order to select, in your words, those which most effectively represent the Apollo program. Can you just take us inside that process? I mean, what sorts of things were you looking for that would, in your words, most effectively represent Apollo and its accomplishment?
Yeah, it was incredibly difficult. I mean, the concept of the book, it isn't just those remastered, the fact that something was really poor and kind of, ta-da, look at how nice it is now. It's not a gimmicky book. There are those moments in it, but the concept is it's the ultimate or definitive photograph record of the whole of Apollo. And so, firstly, there needs to be images from every mission, from Apollo 7 through to Apollo 17. Also, they need to tell the story of each mission. So I researched every photograph and worked out exactly when it was taken, who took it, what is it that we're looking at, what point in the mission is it, and what the astronauts saying at the time that they witnessed these incredible vistas. Hmm. So that they, as well as putting each image into context, they also help, tell the story of the whole program.
Hmm.
So images that help to do that, and in terms of out of those 35,000, anyone that's put any family photo album together from the favorite vacation will appreciate it can be hard. So imagine when you've got 35,000 of the most incredible things humans have ever seen. It was an incredibly difficult process. But there are different types of images. There are images that have historical significance. There are images that reveal something we've never been able to see before. There are images that just instantly convey the awe-inspiring nature of human space exploration. They just hit you. It's just an incredible vista. There's also panoramic shots. So they took sequences of photographs, and I've enhanced those and stitched them together, and they're great at just being able to convey the grandeur and scale of a lunar landscape, and also particularly if they've got a person in them.
Mm.
And that's the final key. That's the one really important thing I wanted to get across in the book, is to show the human side. We tend not to see it. They didn't tend to take photographs of each other, so they're quite rare. When we do, what we've often seen is, an anonymous figure, a puffy white spacesuit and a gold visor.
Hmm.
And what I want to do is be able to maybe see through the visor, look through the windows, and also to be able to step on board the spacecraft and almost ride along with these space explorers.
Hmm.
So a combination of all those types of images and also ones that tell the story of the program made it into the book. But there's 400. So, it's a big book. I don't know if you've had a copy. It's a big, heavy book.
Yes.
and there's over 400 images in it. So that's a good opportunity to get a good spread of every mission.
Absolutely. One of the things, I applaud you for many things, but one of the chief things I want to applaud you for is that it seems to me that somebody who is in your business of working with photographs and trying to achieve the most exquisite sort of perfection, I could imagine someone in your position gravitating towards only those photographs that in a sense are of pristine perfection and you showing grandeur and so on. I so appreciate the fact that your book is not just that, but also a certain number of photographs that are sort of fuzzy and in a sense imperfect, but they are some of the most fascinating images in this book. Just to highlight one that I'll have you talk about, there's a really interesting photograph from Apollo 11, which is taken from the lunar module, pointed down at the surface, and we see stuff that has been, in a sense, thrown out onto the surface of the moon at the foot of the ladder. Explain this interesting image. I'm so glad it's there.
Yeah, it's actually something I didn't know existed. I didn't know we could see. It's actually Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin's PLSS, or the backpack. So at the end of the mission, when they got back into the lunar module, they left all kinds of things behind on the moon, including the Hasselblad camera, much to my dismay. But they had to minimize, so they can maximize sample return of rock, they had to leave stuff behind. So anything that they really didn't need was kind of tossed overboard. So, yeah, once they got back in the lunar module, they connected up to the systems in the spacecraft, opened the hatch, and they kind of pushed out the backpacks that obviously kept them alive on the lunar surface, and they tumbled down the ladder and landed at the foot of Eagle, of the lunar module. And they took some 60mm film. It was very underexposed. But with this stacking technique and enhancing it and bringing out the shadow detail, we can now see those two backpacks lying on top of each other. And you're right, it's not a great quality image, but it's such a poignant one. It's, you know, that's how we would, if you went back to the landing site, to Tranquility Base, that's how we'd find it.
Hmm.
You know, this permanent memorial to one of the greatest ever human achievement.
Right. A very poignant image, speaking of memorials, comes from Apollo 15 and a photograph that Dave Scott took of something which he left on the surface of the moon. And the caption of the photograph suggests that this is something that the folks back home, that is at NASA, did not know was going to occur. Would you mind telling our listeners about this beautiful memorial that Dave Scott elected to leave on the lunar surface?
Yeah, they took a little kind of piece of artwork. It was a little sculpture, and it was named The Fallen Astronaut. And alongside that, he left a small plaque with the names of people who had lost their lives from the Russian side as well as the US side in the pursuit of reaching the moon, including, of course, most poignantly, perhaps those from the Apollo 1 fire. So there's a list of all the names, and he photographed that with the fallen astronaut in the lunar dust as a permanent memorial to those people. Mm. Back home, they didn't know. So actually, Mission Control, when you read the transcripts, when I was researching this, they said, Dave, what are you doing now? And he basically said, oh, we're just tidying some things up near the rover. He's kind of out of shot of the camera, and that's actually what he was doing, as he was laying this memorial and taking the photograph.
And I just think it's so beautiful that that plaque contains the names of both fallen astronauts from the United States and fallen cosmonauts from the then Soviet Union. I just think that is in and of itself such a beautiful aspect of that. You mentioned the fact that these photographs are preserved in a way and presented in chronological order, at least to at whatever extent it is possible to know that. I'd never stopped to think about actually how complicated a matter that would be. Can you just briefly explain the challenge of trying to figure out when a given photograph was taken in the course of a mission in order to present them in chronological order?
Yeah, well, the issue lies in the fact that they took multiple magazines. Of course, this is film, so it's not like digital cameras where everyone was numbered. It was rolls of film in magazines, up to 200 per magazine, multiple cameras. So although you know the order within a magazine, they're clearly chronological. They may take 10 from that magazine, and then someone else may be taking with another camera the next six with their camera and their magazine. So that's the complexity to work it out. I mean, I understood the missions. I understood the chronology of what they were trying to achieve. So that helped. There's resources online. There's studying the transcripts of what they were saying at the time. Even went to the length of, for example, with the 60mm film, there's no indication at all when in the mission that was. But, for example, the camera may pan past the mission counter. There was a mission timer in the command module that was started at launch, and so that gives you the hours, minutes, and seconds from launch to whatever point they filmed it. So that was a clue. I had a great time on Zoom with Rusty Swikart looking at Apollo 9, and we were looking at that film and even saying, well, given how much stubble is on his crewmates, that indicates, you know, how many days into the mission we may be.
Wow.
So there's a whole host of information. Even the photograph, you can tell the which window it was taken out of, and therefore who is in that position on the spacecraft to work out who took it. So it was a combination of lots of different factors, and it wasn't a straightforward process.
Your book includes the famous photograph known as Earthrise, from that first time we were to the moon and looking back at the planet Earth rising above the horizon of the moon. But your book, most remarkably, actually contains a photograph taken right before the so-called Earthrise photograph, one of the most famous photographs ever taken. This other one is, in some respects, still more beautiful. Briefly explain its inclusion in the book.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. But yeah, most people assume that the Earthrise color shot is the first photograph of Earth from the moon. But in fact, you're right, there was a black and white one, or a couple of black and white ones taken just before. And that was all part of the scramble. So again, in researching this, the crew of Apollo 8 had actually made three orbits before they even noticed Earthrise because the orientation of the spacecraft. Then when Bill Anders noticed it through the window, he was, you know, you can hear it in his voice. He's like, oh my God, look at this. We have to get this photograph. And he only had black and white. So he started to take on black and white. And in the meantime, he's shouting to his crewmate, you know, get me a roll of color quick. And I think it was Jim Lovell that finally found the roll of color. They got that on the camera, and then he got the Earthrise shot. So the color one was second and, of course, more famous. But actually, there was a black and white one taken just a little earlier.
Mm. Wonderful. Apollo 9's Rusty Schweikert says we should take this book and read it in darkness in order to fully appreciate these beautiful images. And again, it's a magnificent book. Apollo Remastered, the Ultimate Photographic Record, and responsible for it, Andy Saunders. Mr. Saunders, thank you so much for giving the world this extraordinary book. What a beautiful accomplishment. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you again, Greg. Thank you.
I want to mention a couple of other interesting photographs that are part of this book called Apollo Remastered. As we touched on very briefly in the conversation, the book contains not only photographs from the Apollo missions, but also a few photographs from the Mercury and Gemini programs. There is, for instance, a beautiful photograph of the Earth taken during Alan Shepard's suborbital flight back in 1961, the first time a photograph was taken that showed clearly the curvature of the Earth. There's also a photograph from John Glenn's flight, the first orbital flight around the Earth, in which he took a picture with a camera that he bought at their local dime store. So an imperfect photograph, but a precious memento from that historic occasion. The book includes the first selfie ever taken in space by Buzz Aldrin back in 1966. And there's an even more extraordinary so-called selfie taken during Apollo 9. Extraordinary because it includes the images of all three astronauts in the command module. It's one of the only instances in which we see such a sight. There are all kinds of other beautiful images that are part of this amazing book. Again, it is titled Apollo Remastered, the Ultimate Photographic Record. Each chapter begins with text with the headline, The Mission, in which Andy Saunders outlines the purpose and schedule of each mission, what was hoped to accomplish, what in fact was accomplished, and of course the names of the astronauts for each mission are included as well. And every photograph, all 400, include a caption which tells us who took the photograph and what that photograph represents. The book is published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers. I highly recommend Apollo Remastered. It's a beautiful way to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Apollo 17, the last mission that NASA made to the moon. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the years, I've been privileged to speak with several different astronauts on the morning show, including Buzz Aldrin, one of the first men to walk on the surface of the moon as part of Apollo 11. Most recently, I spoke with Al Warden, a member of the crew of Apollo 15. The occasion was the publication of his fascinating and remarkably candid memoir called Falling to Earth. Here's an excerpt. You make an interesting point in this chapter that, I mean, in some ways it's absolutely obvious, and yet I think it's worth talking about for just a moment. And this is where you're kind of talking about the point I was trying to make earlier, which is that just it feels like there's something absolutely extraordinary about this ordinary kid from an ordinary farm going on to be an astronaut who goes to the moon. You write, "Even if I had known that there would one day be astronauts and I might wish to become one, when I was growing up, there was no way of learning how. In fact, when I was born, there were no such people as astronauts, nor rockets able to reach into space. I grew up in a place that was about as far away from that high-tech world as it is possible to imagine, a rural childhood in 1930s Michigan." That's a really important point, because I think we look back now and we feel like there's this sweep of destiny somehow, that this is always what you were going to be. And yet your life could have turned out in all kinds of other ways that would have taken you nowhere near NASA.
Well, you know, Greg, it's kind of interesting. Let me make two points. One, when I think about all that, I think about my grandmother. She was alive when Apollo 11 made its flight to the moon. When she was young, living on a farm, there was no electricity, there's no running water. They had an old crank telephone. If back on the old country line with six other people on the line. They didn't have any car, automobile, and she lived long enough for someone to step foot on the moon. And I just, you know, looking back on that, I think that is just absolutely amazing that the technology could grow so fast, be advanced so quickly that we could actually, in one lifetime, go from horse and buggy to landing a man on the moon. And I just think that is absolutely amazing for any country in the world. And it's just a testament to what this country can do. The other thing I wanted to mention is that, I grew up on a farm, and I went to West Point, went in the Air Force and all that. And I think that is can happen in this country. This is the one country in the world where no matter where you are born, what your circumstances are, what the environment is, if you really dedicate yourself to going somewhere and doing something, you can do it. And there's no excuse for anyone not getting an education and not putting themselves in a position where they're really moving ahead with their lives. And I think only in this country can that happen. It's just a wonderful country, and the opportunities are there for anyone.
You share some interesting stories about your life at West Point, but one of my favorite stories involves an experience you had in the Glee Club and a performance you were asked to do down in New Orleans.
Yeah.
This is a great little story. Do you mind sharing it with our listeners?
Oh, we're talking back in the 1950s now. And segregation was just an open thing in this country back in those days. I was in the Glee Club, and we had a couple of black guys in the Glee Club with me. There were blacks in West Point back in those days. See, the Army was kind of colorless. It didn't care. We had a scheduled performance to do in New Orleans, and when they made reservations for all of the Glee Club in a hotel in New Orleans, and everything was all set, and the hotel called back and wanted to know if there were any blacks in the Glee Club, and we said yes, and they said, well, we'd have to put them up at a different hotel. And so the Glee Club all voted on it, every single guy and said, okay, we're going to cancel the appearance because if we can't all stay together, we're not going to go at all. So that's kind of how things were at West Point. West Point was colorblind and didn't make any difference who you were. And that was very, very different from what was happening in the rest of the country. Considering that we're talking 1950s when, you know, this was still a big thing in the country. So I'm always proud of that we banded together and said, if we can't all go, then none of us will go.
Hmm. You talk about the simple and unforgiving rules at West Point. And one of the best ways we understand just how strict life was there is when you explain why you were most likely passed over for the prestigious position of commanding a regiment. It has to do with something you did with a girl that violated the rules.
Yeah. In my sophomore year, which is called yearling year at West Point, we spent the summer out at a training facility called Camp Buckner, which is about 20 miles west of West Point. And we spent the summer going through all the primary military stuff, learning how to fire rifles, and we did everything. We did field maneuvers. We learned how to drive tanks. We learned all about artillery. We learned all of that kind of stuff. Well, on weekends we had the time off. And one time, and Camp Buckner, I should mention, is on the shore of a lake, which was a very, very pretty lake. And we had rowboats and canoes and things that on weekends we could go over to the other side of the lake and, you know, just kind of have a nice day. Well, I was on the other side of the lake one day with a girl, and I was helping her cross some stones on the edge of the water. One of the tactical officers back at Camp Buckner had a pair of binoculars watching everybody to make sure that we were not doing something wrong. And he caught me holding this girl's hand to help her across some rocks, and I got written up for it. And the result of that was it's called public display of affection, which actually I was trying to be nice and help her across. But it didn't make any difference. I ended up spending some punishment tours on the in Central Barracks. I think I spent 8 hours walking the area. And what you do is you get all dressed up in your finest uniform, and you get a rifle, and you march back and forth in straight lines for an hour or two or three. I think I spent 8 hours doing that.
Wow.
And, that didn't help any.
You're right. They did not fool around when it came to infractions of the rules.
No, they didn't. They didn't. They were pretty harsh, and it put you in mind of the rules and made you toe the line pretty carefully.
We're speaking with Al Worden, former NASA Apollo astronaut, talking about his memoir, Falling to Earth. And it says something about your book that here we are spending all this time with the front part of the book before you ever get to NASA, before you ever get to the moon. But it's a very, very interesting story. You end up choosing the Air Force, and you have a very, very interesting experience there. I want you to just say a word about one thing which you observed early on, and that was an interesting generation gap, a kind of tension between two different generations of aviators. I found this really interesting.
I'm not quite sure what you're referring to there, Greg.
This is your second year at Andrews.
Okay, yeah, that was kind of an interesting time. I got to Andrews in early 1957. Flying Air Defense Command fighters out of Andrews Air Force Base, which is just outside Washington. And the thing that became quite clear to me is that most of the flight commanders and on up were World War II pilots who, at the end of the war, were reduced in rank to sergeants. They were all temporary officers. And then when the Korean War came along, they were reactivated as officers and as pilots, and they all went to jet aircraft transition, and so they were called what was called in those days the Blue Flame Program, and they all came into the squadron and started flying the fighters along with the rest of us. And the thing I realized was that these guys that were in World War II and came back as officers, captains, and majors weren't particularly happy with young guys, particularly those who had gone to West Point and gotten the education that they did, because most of the older guys didn't have that kind of education. And so it was kind of a there was kind of a constant tension between the two groups. And you know, West Pointers were not looked at very favorably by the old guard, who really didn't have a chance to advance very far because they didn't have the background for it. They were pilots only, and probably were never going to advance in rank very far. But we, who had gone to West Point, there were several of us in the squadron at the time. We were kind of put off to the side for a while because these older fellows didn't want us to go too fast up in rank.
You end up pursuing the work of test pilot, which you found to be, in your words, a natural career path for you, and you engage in an interesting exchange program, which takes you off to England and inspires some.
Well, that was an interesting story there too. I after 5 or 6 years, I guess 6 years in the fighter squadron, Air Defense Command wanted me to come to headquarters because of some things that I had done in the squadron. They wanted me to be a staff officer at headquarters, going out and visiting all the squadrons. And I decided that if I'm going to sit behind a desk, I really wanted to do it to help me, too. I mean, for my own good, not just the Air Force. So I went across the river to the Pentagon and got a hold of the senior master sergeant who handled the Civilian Institute program. And he got me an assignment back to the University of Michigan, where I spent almost 2.5 years getting a couple of master's degrees. Well, while I was there, two of the fellows that were in the classes with me, one was the deputy commander of the test pilot school at Edwards, and the other was the head of academics there. And I became quite friendly with them, and they insisted that I apply to test pilot school for various reasons, and I did. But when the list for the test pilot school came out, I was not on it. And I thought, well, I'm pretty philosophical about stuff like that, and I thought, well, I just didn't cut the mustard, if you so to speak, to go to the test pilot school. A couple of weeks later, I got a call from, of all people, the Secretary of the Air Force. And he said, I guess you saw the list and that you weren't on it. And I said, yeah, I sure did. He said, well, you were right at the top of the list, but we took you off because we want to send you to England to the test pilot school. We'd had an exchange program with the RAF for a long time, and the pilots that they sent over had not particularly distinguished themselves in a test pilot school, so they wanted somebody with the academic background to go, and with a flying experience too, because they wanted to show that, you know, we could compete with the British. So I went there for a year, flying out of Farnborough, which is southwest of London, about 30 miles, and flew all these British airplanes. Most of them were kind of like World War II airplanes. We flew Meteors and we flew Hawker Hunters and the B-57, which they called the Canberra, and I was current. I think they checked me out in like 13 different airplanes. Probably the best experience of my life because I just loved it over there, and I'm very, very close to the guys that I went to school with there. In fact, I just had a reunion here a couple of months ago with them over in England. But it was an astounding, fascinating year that I spent over there. And at the end of that year, I came in second in my class over there, out of about 30 or 40 pilots. And at the end of that year, the U.S. Test Pilot School came over for a visit, and the commandant at the time was a guy by the name of Chuck Yeager, and he came up to me and said, I need you back to teach at the school. So that's how I got back.
You mentioned, by the way, that the British did things with a little less reliance on electronic devices.
Yes.
And you thought that was really good. You learned a lot as a test pilot by having to work, in a sense, with slightly more primitive conditions.
Well, we had totally primitive conditions. The U.S. at the time was moving towards instrumenting their airplanes so that the pilot had a flight plan to fly, but he didn't have to do any of the analysis. He didn't have to do any of the thinking about what the airplane was doing. Over there, you had to carry all anything you took on a flight to measure something, you had to carry with you like a yardstick to measure how far you deflect the control stick to make a certain maneuver. And that puts you into thinking about the airplane. What is the airplane doing? When I pull a stick back 2 inches, what happens? And you record all that information, and then you do your own analysis. And I thought that was a wonderful way to learn how to test an airplane rather than relying on technicians in a control room analyzing all the data that you collect on the flight. You actually had to think about it yourself. And I thought that made us better test pilots.
Hmm. Well, it's in the midst of this work with Chuck Yeager that the opportunity comes along to apply for NASA. They were doing their fifth intake of new astronauts in the fall of 1965. You saw this as your last chance. Tell us why this felt like a last chance for you and NASA.
Well, that's very simple. As a matter of fact, I never really thought they would have a selection program that would allow me an opportunity to get in. And that's because the limiting age on being selected into the program was 35, and I was getting close to that. And I thought, well, they'll never have another application, a request, before I turned 35. Well, lo and behold, they did. And that's the first time I really had considered being an astronaut seriously. I had kind of focused my life on the test flying work and doing the best I could. And when they had an application program, I thought it was kind of interesting because as soon as NASA had an application, a request for applicants, the Air Force came out the same time with a request for applicants because they were doing the manned orbiting lab program, the initial stages of the manned orbiting lab program, and they didn't want NASA to take all the top guys. So there was this dual program, and I decided at the time that I'd apply NASA only because I had no confidence that the Air Force could ever get a space program off the ground, which turned out to be right. And I got into NASA in the spring of 1966 along with 18 other guys, and there were about 7 or 8 fellows that were with me at Edwards at the time who applied either just to the Air Force or to both, and the Air Force kind of picked those guys up. And then when the MOLE program was eliminated, I think 6 of them came down to Houston. That would be in 1969. They joined us in Houston from the MOLE program. So it was kind of an interesting time, and I was, that was probably the happiest day of my life is when I got the call from Deke Slayton saying, hey, would you like to come down and join us?
Amazing. You say that over and over again, you had a very dramatic sense of being one of the new kids on the block. And in particular, whenever you were around any of the original 7 astronauts, that must have been such an interesting experience to be given this fabulous opportunity and yet to have in some ways felt like a freshman in college or maybe a freshman in high school for that matter.
Well, it's the same. I think no matter what you do in life, I think that when you take the next step, you have to start out on the bottom rung of the next ladder. I felt that way when I went to West Point. I was just amazed when I went to West Point that all these guys that were in my class were so bright and so smart, and they were athletic, and they were this, and they were that. And I think, how in the world am I ever going to compete with these guys? And then after a few months, I realized that, hey, I'm probably as well qualified as those guys to do the job, but you have to start out at the bottom. And when I went to when I learned how to fly an airplane, same thing all over again. When I went back to college, same thing. I was, I'd been like out 6 years in the service and went back to college, and I'm in classes with freshmen that are coming in. I'm thinking, man, I'm starting at the bottom again. When I got into the astronaut program, it's the same thing. A bunch of the older fellows who had been there, the original 7, the next few groups that were flying the Gemini program, and, man, you're at the bottom of the ladder again, sweeping the floors and getting coffee for everybody else. And you have to prove yourself. You have to do your own thing, and you have to work your own way ahead. And it takes a while to do that. You don't do that overnight, and it takes a while to get acceptance by the guys who've already made a flight into space. See, the attitude back in those days was that the whole world thinks you're an astronaut, but we don't because you haven't made a flight in space yet. Mm. So you got to make a flight before they accept you as an astronaut.
And part of that is the fact that we're talking about a limited number of opportunities to actually go into space. And just the sheer mathematics, you tell us, meant that it was not a surprise that some of those older astronauts resented this sudden influx of still more potential astronauts. I mean, it was a very stiff competition. I mean, people desperate to get up in space. You tell us some people from your group waited 20 years for their first flight.
We had guys that waited 20 years and longer to finally go into space. And the competition is tough, and the older guys who are in a position to throw a little weight around, they're looking for more flights too. So it's pretty tough to get on a flight. Thankfully, Deke Slayton, who is our boss, his philosophy was that if you're in the program, you got this far, you're just as qualified to go into space as anybody, because they were in the same boat before they made their flight. So, you know, we were all considered in our own group ready to go fly when the time was right, and that's what happens. You start out with a lot of classroom, then you go on a support crew, like I did on Apollo 9, and then get selected on. Then my particular crew, Dave Scott, myself, and Jim Irwin, were selected by Deke to be backup crew for Apollo 12, and then in the normal course of events back in those days, we would get the third flight down the road, which would be Apollo 15, and that's what happened.
One of the most interesting things you do, this is back on the ground, I mean, long before you ended up making your flight with Apollo 15, but there were several of you who got really frustrated with one of the classroom courses that you were forced to take, a class that apparently was not being taught all that well. And you and a couple of your colleagues believed and knew that you could teach it better.
Yeah. Well, see, we were probably better educated than the instructors we had. The kind of the minimum requirements to get into the program is a bachelor's degree, but what happened is the group that was selected, the average educational level was multiple master's degrees. We had several with PhDs. So we had a pretty high academic background. And we got a little dissatisfied with the way we were being taught, so we went to Al Shepard, who was the senior astronaut in the office at the time. Of course, he was head of the astronaut office, and we told him, said, "Hey, we can do a better job of teaching this than those guys can." So Al said, "Okay, go ahead and do it." So he gave us the job of teaching everybody else.
As crews begin to take shape, your first big responsibility is as part of the support crew for Apollo 9, which was, I think, the second Apollo flight to go to the moon, although not land on the moon. Can you tell us what your role was as part of the support crew for Apollo 9?
Well, first off, we were first going to be support crew on Apollo 8, which was going to be the first Earth orbital checkout of the lunar module. What happened was that the lunar module wasn't ready in time, so they shifted that responsibility to Apollo 9, and then they had Apollo 8 sitting there with no lunar module, so they decided to send it to the moon by itself, and that was the famous flight to the moon on Apollo 8 with Frank Borman and Jim Lovell and Bill Anders. And then Apollo 9 was the first orbital checkout of the lunar module, and that's the flight that I worked on then. I got shifted back a flight. It was very successful. My responsibility was the docking system between the two vehicles, and I spent a lot of time at the contractor helping work out all the bugs and testing the docking system. So I was in pretty good shape on the command module side of things.
One of the most interesting things that confronted potential members of these various Apollo missions was what position to go for, what position to desire. And it seems like almost right from the beginning, you were interested in the position that you that ultimately was yours. Or if that's not quite true, I mean, you quickly realized this was what you most wanted to do on an Apollo mission, even though it meant not actually being one of the two astronauts who would go all the way to the surface of the moon. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your particular role on Apollo 15 and why it was so fitting for you.
Well, when I was at Downey, California, checking out a spacecraft when we had the fire on the launch pad, and I had been working in a command module for a couple of reasons. One was that it is by far the most complicated system from the navigation and the propulsion and the guidance and all that kind of stuff, and I enjoyed that part of it. But after the fire, I spent roughly a year and a half at the manufacturers working with the committee that was to redesign the Apollo spacecraft and take care of all the problems that it had, so that we could have successful flights. And that put me in a position where I knew the command and service module inside and out, and that was a natural thing for me to do. On the other hand, being a command module pilot was something I wanted to do because for two reasons. One is, command module pilot gets to do most of the flying on the flight. Once we launch, then the command module pilot is the guy who flies everybody to the moon, stays in orbit by himself, and then flies everybody back home. And so that gave me the most amount of flying time in terms of stick time, we'll call it. Actually flying something. The lunar module pilot never gets to fly anything. The other thing is that in those days, the most direct path to becoming a commander was to be a command module pilot first, because a command module pilot already knows the command service module inside and out, and all he has to do is learn the lunar module. The lunar module pilot doesn't get a chance to fly anything, so he's got to learn both of them. So that's a double whammy on a guy who's an LMP. To become a commander, and it only happened once in the program, and that was Gene Cernan on Apollo 17. And the rest of the commanders all went through the command module pilot stage before they became a commander.
You make all kinds of interesting points about these Apollo flights, but one of them that really jumped out at me, you said, one misconception is that the Apollo spacecraft used cutting-edge technology. In fact, the spacecraft that flew in the late 1960s and early 70s used equipment mostly designed in the 1950s. And I thought it was so interesting. You suggest maybe one of the reasons why. It was not an accident. It was a conscious decision made by NASA to rely mostly on well-known technology. Explain that.
Yes. No question about it. The goal back in those days was to build a system that was reliable. And by using the technology that would do the job, but had all those years of testing behind it, made for a much more reliable system than if you use cutting-edge technology that you're not really sure what all the weak points are, where all the weak points are. So we used technology that had been developed in the late 50s for different like military programs, like the computer that we carried was not a high-tech computer. It was a small hand-wired computer that you couldn't hurt. You could drop it, you could zap it, you could do anything with it, and when you put power back on it, it came right back to life again, same as it did before. Very, very reliable computer. The problem with it was that it had a very limited memory capacity, and in terms of today's computers, it's almost a joke, because we had a total programmable memory in that computer of 75K, and today you find that much in a wristwatch or more. So it was a pretty crude system, but it did everything we needed to do in the flight, and we got those because they were so reliable.
Astronaut Al Warden's fascinating memoir is called Falling to Earth. It was co-written with Francis French. And you can hear this interview in its entirety in the podcast version of The Morning Show. Tomorrow on the morning show, retired Kenosha Unified Band Director Ken Wheely, who has become an amazingly accomplished and gifted nature photographer and has put together a stunningly beautiful book, which is called Musings, which is just out in a